evidence of maladministration by the Civil Service Commission. There was a series of interminable examinations by Roosevelt of George H. Paul, who had been brought in from Milwaukee especially for that purpose. The humiliated ex-postmaster sat for 3 days in his chair, helpless as a trussed turkey, while Roosevelt determinedly pulled out his feathers one by one. Squawks of protest that Paul had given all this testimony before and had already suffered amply for it went unheeded. Roosevelt seemed determined to show the committee what an angry civil service commissioner looked like in action. Not until late in the afternoon of Friday, 7 March, did the chairman tactfully suggest that enough was enough. Even before the committee filed its formal report, it was plain that Roosevelt had scored a personal triumph. He had dominated the hearings from the first day to the last, and had somehow managed to arouse sympathy for his patronage of Shady Shidy, as that gentleman was now known. His prestige as civil service commissioner had been greatly enhanced, at the expense of the discredited Lyman and the reticent Thompson. The committee was rumored to be in favor of recommending the creation of a single-headed commission, with himself the obvious choice as chief. But Roosevelt, surprisingly, opposed this idea, saying that it was attractive but premature. To put a Republican in sole control, he argued, would compromise the commission's nonpartisan image and make it vulnerable to changing majorities in Congress. This was true enough, but sophisticated observers could detect signs of a larger, more long-term ambition in Roosevelt's modesty. He already had all the power the inadequate civil service law allowed him. Killing two colleagues off would not increase it. At 31, he could afford to wait a few more years for real power. Roosevelt himself admitted, later in life, that it was about this time that he began to cast thoughtful eyes upon 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. "I used to walk by the White House, and my heart would beat a little faster as the thought came to me that possibly, I would someday occupy it as president." Jeremiah Curtin, the translator of Shinkaevich, happened to catch him in the act one day during a visit to the White House with Representative Frederick T. Greenhalgh of the House Civil Service Committee. "That man," said Curtin, "looks precisely as if he had examined the building and, finding it to his liking, had made up his mind to inhabit it." "I must make you acquainted with him," replied Greenhalgh. "But first, listen to a prophecy. When he wants this house, he will get it. He will yet live here as president." March merged into April, April into May, but the committee, plagued by absenteeism, kept postponing its report. Roosevelt grew impatient and nervous. "It is very important that the present commission be given an absolutely clean bill of health. A verdict against us is a verdict against the reform and against decency." Frank Hatton, too, seemed bothered by the suspense. His editorial attacks on Roosevelt grew hysterical. "This scion of better blood," he raged, "this pampered pink of inherited wealth, this 7 months child of conceited imbecility, is a sham, a pretender, and a fraud as a reformer, and a failure as a businessman." Eventually, the flow of vituperation ceased. The Post, having passed the pestiferous Roosevelt between its thumbnails, drops him and awaits the report of the investigating committee. As usual in times of stress, Roosevelt distracted himself with literature and worked doggedly on his long-postponed history of New York City. "How I regret ever having undertaken it!" By way of relaxation, he wrote 3 or 4 hunting pieces for Century, and by way of duty, some very dull articles on civil service reform. He apologized to George Haven Putnam for having to abandon, temporarily, volumes 3 and 4 of his magnum opus. "I half wish I was out of this Civil Service Commission work, for I can't do satisfactorily with the winning of the West until I am. But I suppose I ought really to stand by it for at least a couple of years." He spent one of the most important weekends of his life on 10 and 11 May, reading from cover to cover Alfred Thayer Mahan's new book, The Influence of Sea Power Upon History. Since the publication of his own Naval War of 1812, he had considered himself an expert on this very subject, and had argued passionately but vaguely that modernization of the fleet must keep pace with the industrialization of the economy. But he had never questioned America's traditional naval strategy, based on a combination of coastal defense and commercial raiding. Now, Mahan extended and clarified his vision, showing that real national security and international greatness could only be attained by building more and bigger ships and deploying them farther abroad. While advocating the constant growth of the American Navy, Mahan paradoxically insisted that its power be concentrated at various pressure points which controlled the circulation of global commerce. By striking quickly and sharply at any of these nerve centers, the United States could paralyze whole oceans. Mahan supported his thesis with brilliant analyses of the strategies of Nelson and Napoleon, proving that navies could be more effective than armies in determining the relative strength of nations. He also explained the intricate relationships between political power and sea power, warfare and economics, geography and technology. Roosevelt flipped the book shut a changed man. So, as it happened, did Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany when he read it, not to mention various lords of the British and Japanese admiralties and officials throughout the Navy Department of the United States. More than any other strategic philosopher, Alfred Thayer Mahan was responsible for the naval buildup which preoccupied these four nations at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries. More than any other world leader of the period, Theodore Roosevelt would glory in the influence of sea power upon history, both as a title and as a fact. The report of the House Committee's investigation, filed 13 June 1890, stated that the public service has been greatly benefited and the law, on the whole, well executed by all three commissioners. Charles Lyman was mildly censured for a certain laxity of discipline in administrative affairs, while his colleagues received unqualified praise. We find that Commissioners Roosevelt and Thompson have discharged their duties with entire fidelity and integrity, the document stated. Whitewash! Screamed the Washington Post. But most press comment was approving. The New York Times and Evening Post went so far as to criticize President Harrison and Postmaster General Wanamaker for not supporting the Civil Service Commission. Roosevelt returned with some relief to bureaucratic work. During his first year in office, he had attracted a greater glare of publicity than his eight predecessors put together. It was time to retire temporarily to the wings before he was accused of hogging the footlights. Already, the Saturday Globe was warning, "There is perhaps no man in the country more ambitious than this young New York politician." Once again, Washington began to drowse in summer heat. Edith and the children returned to Sagamore Hill. Cecil Spring Rice fled for the cool shores of Massachusetts. Henry Adams prepared to depart for the South Seas. Congress remained in session, with Speaker Reed presiding over the House in flannels and canvas shoes, a yellow scarf around his enormous waist. Roosevelt went to Oyster Bay as often as he could, but pressure of work, for the commission was still backlogged, continually drew him back. He managed to finish his very commonplace little book on New York by the beginning of August, and spent the next 3 weeks feverishly trying to clear his desk. Another Western trip was in the offing, this time to Yellowstone, which he wished to inspect on behalf of the Boone and Crockett Club. But administrative difficulties nearly made him cancel it. "Oh, heaven, if the president had a little backbone, and if the senators did not have flannel legs!" The 1st of September found Roosevelt and a large family party, including his wife and two sisters, heading west to Medora and the Rockies. Impressed as he was by the splendors of Yellowstone, he reserved his most admiring adjectives for Edith. The sight of that demure, book-loving lady cantering across the prairie on a wiry horse seemed to have shocked him into a renewed awareness of her charms. "She looks just as well and young and pretty as she did 4 years ago when I married her. She is as healthy as possible, and so young-looking and slender to be the mother of those two sturdy little scamps, Ted and Kermit." Washington was still deserted when he got back there in early October. Benjamin Harrison was at home, however, so Roosevelt paid a friendly call. Harrison, who had gotten into the habit of drumming his fingers nervously during their interviews, gave him a frigid reception. Evidently the White House wanted to have nothing further to do with civil service reform. "Damn the president! He is a cold-blooded, narrow-minded, prejudiced, obstinate, timid old psalm-singing Indianapolis politician." The November congressional elections were disastrous for the Republican Party, due mainly to an unpopular tariff measure which William McKinley had pushed into law at the end of the last session. With prices on manufactured goods rising daily, voters threw the culprit out of office, severely damaging his presidential prospects, and filled the House with the largest Democratic majority in history. Roosevelt, who had never liked the McKinley bill, began to mutter dire predictions about Cleveland recapturing the White House in 1892. But with his family reinstalled in town, and Henry Cabot Lodge by great luck returned to Congress, he found it impossible to be gloomy. Indeed, Roosevelt was conspicuously the most cheerful Republican in Washington that winter. He continues to wear the nattiest and most stylish gray trousers and the most boyish hat he can buy, reported a local correspondent. And he whistles jovially as he legs it down to the rooms of the Civil Service Commission. Christmas was spent at 1820 Jefferson Place, and Roosevelt rejoiced in the event as much as any of his children. Such nice stockings, with such an entrancing way of revealing in their bulging outline the promise of what was inside. They burrowed into them with their eager, chubby little hands and hailed each new treasure with shouts of delight. Then, after breakfast, we all walked into the room where the big toys, so many of them, were on the tables. And I suppose Alice and Ted came as near to realizing the feelings of those who enter paradise as they ever will on this earth. That, according to his old friend Mrs. Winthrop Chandler, was the essence of Theodore Roosevelt, at least during his early years in Washington. Life was the unpacking of an endless Christmas stocking. Chapter 17. The Dear Old Beloved Brother. In his house this malcontent could the king no longer bear. In January 1891, Roosevelt was forced to turn his attention to a nightmare of horror that had been brooding over him for at least 3 years. His preoccupation with literature, politics, and his own immediate family had caused him to ignore warnings that Elliot Roosevelt was determinedly drinking himself to death. The two brothers, so close in youth, had recently seen very little of each other. 20 miles of country road and a yawning social gulf separated their respective Long Island establishments. At Sagamore Hill, the talk was of books and public affairs. At Hempstead, of parties, fashions, and horseflesh. On the rare occasions when the brothers met, friends were struck by the reversal of their teenage roles. Where once Theodore had been sickly and solitary, and Elliot an effulgent Apollo, now it was the elder who glowed, and the younger who was wasting away. It is difficult to say whether Elliot Roosevelt was victim or culprit in his own decline. His misfortunes were physical as well as psychological. Since puberty, he had been afflicted with semi-epileptic seizures, usually brought on by stress, and when still adolescent, discovered that alcohol was an effective depressant. Long before his 21st birthday, Elliot was drinking heavily, although his good looks and athletic bearing tended to disguise the fact. After marrying the beautiful but, in Theodore's view, utterly frivolous Anna Hall, he had become a confirmed alcoholic. Withdrawal from drink after binges only worsened his tendency to epilepsy. A series of inexplicable sporting accidents, which may have been caused by seizures, progressively wrecked his health. The most serious of these, a fall from a trapeze during amateur theatricals in 1888, temporarily crippled his leg, and he became dependent on laudanum and morphine during the agony of recuperation. There had been a complete physical collapse in 1889, followed by such desperate drinking during the early part of 1890 as to shock even himself into awareness of his impending doom. Swearing never to touch alcohol again, he left the United States for Europe that summer, taking his wife, 6-year-old daughter, and baby son with him. From Vienna, in September 1890, came news of the inevitable relapse, followed shortly before Christmas by a cri de coeur from Anna. She was pregnant again and was afraid of spending the winter alone with her unstable husband. If Bammy, ever willing, ever capable Bammy, would come over and look after her, Elliot could surely be persuaded to enter a sanitarium for treatment. By the time the baby was born, he should be decently dried out, and they could all return happily to New York in time for the next social season. Although Theodore considered Anna's optimism thoroughly Chinese, he did see the advisability of Bammy's presence in Vienna. But no sooner had he given his official permission, as head of the family, than a bombshell announcement on legal stationery arrived from New York. His brother's seed, apparently, was also sprouting in the body of a servant girl named Katie Mann. She claimed to have been seduced by Elliot shortly before his departure for Europe, and threatened a public scandal if she did not receive financial compensation for her pregnancy. Roosevelt's reaction to this hideous revelation was entirely characteristic. "Of course he was insane when he did it," Alcoholism he believed to be a disease that could be treated and cured. But infidelity was a crime, pure and simple. It could be neither forgiven nor understood, save as an act of madness. It was an offense against order, decency, against civilization. It was a desecration of the holy marriage bed. By reducing himself to the level of a flagrant man-swine, Elliot had forfeited all claim to his wife and children. For Anna to continue to live with him now would be little short of criminal, he told Bammy. She ought not to have any more children, and those she has should be brought up away from him. Were it not for Anna's present delicate condition, she was a frail person at the best of times, Theodore would no doubt have ordered Bammy to fetch her home at once. There was nothing to do but let Bammy go over as planned and privately confront Elliot with the news. If nothing else, it might sober him up long enough to commit himself to a sanitarium for treatment. Such an act of voluntary self-incarceration, wrote Theodore, will serve to explain and atone for what cannot otherwise ever be explained. As souls pass through purgatory in order to wash away sin, so, presumably, could a repentant Elliot redeem his fit of insanity. In the meantime, Theodore and the lawyers would await the birth of Katie Mann's baby. Should any Roosevelt blood be identifiable in it, they would pay her whatever hush money was necessary. Bammy sailed for Europe in early February 1891. While she was still on the high seas, Theodore received an affectionate and unsuspecting letter from Elliot. Despite his newfound contempt for the dear old beloved brother, memories of their happy closeness in the past crowded in on him, and he sank into the deepest gloom. It is horrible, awful. It is like a brooding nightmare. If it was mere death, one could stand it. It is the shame that is so fearful. Much of the shame, of course, was his own. He felt acute distaste for the role he had inherited as go-between in a shabby paternity suit. If it ever got out that the Civil Service Commissioner was involved in blackmail payments, Frank Hatton would annihilate him. But he saw no other way of protecting his family from a catastrophic scandal. At the end of February, Bammy wrote to say that Elliot, surprisingly, had already placed himself in the Mariengrund Sanctuary at Graz. He was in a highly excitable state, bursting into tears at the slightest hint of disapproval, so she would wait until he was stronger before telling him about Katie Mann. The incarceration was to last 3 months. Although Theodore was pessimistic about the effects of so short a stay and so luxurious a retreat, he was relieved for Anna's sake. Elliot is purely secondary. With neither of his brother's babies due until the spring, he could devote his full attention to civil service matters. It happened that Roosevelt's family troubles during the early part of 1891 coincided with a period of renewed political difficulties. At times he felt he was battling with everybody, the little gray man in the White House looking on with cold and hesitating disapproval. The struggle was provoked by his efforts to extend the classification of the civil service to all offices in the Indian Bureau. Rioting by Sioux and South Dakota reservations, where maladministration and corruption were rife, had forced him to rethink his old paternal attitudes to the red man, and he now tried to persuade administration officials that Indians should take part, wherever possible, in agency affairs. "I should take the civilized members of the different tribes and put them to work in instructing their fellows in farming, blacksmithing, and the like, and should extend the present system of paid Indian judges and police." But the officials were apathetic, and President Harrison flatly refused to admit that conditions on the reservations were bad. February saw the usual appropriations crisis in Congress. Republican spoilsmen lobbied to such good effect that for 2 days the Civil Service Commission was in danger of losing its entire operating budget. Speaker Reed had to use his massive personal influence before the funds were voted on 14 February. With the departure of Congress in early March, pressure on the Civil Service Commission finally eased, and Roosevelt found himself with little official work to do. His thoughts began to drift toward literature again, for the first reviews of his History of the City of New York were flowing in from both sides of the Atlantic. The British critics were complimentary, if not enthusiastic. It was felt that Roosevelt had done as well as could be expected, given the largeness of his subject and the limitations of his space. "New York was pleasantly written," remarked the Spectator, "but as a story it was not inspiring." Roosevelt had been unable to prove that the city's rapid growth had been to any good purpose. An hour in New York suffices to inform the observing foreigner that it is among the worst governed, worst paved, worst built, and worst ordered cities in the world. Still, one had to admire Roosevelt's condemnation of municipal corruption and his freedom from any trace of chauvinism. It was left to an American periodical, The Nation, to point out that on the contrary, Roosevelt was very chauvinistic indeed. The anonymous reviewer sounded a complaint that would be heard with increasing frequency during the next 10 years. Mr. Roosevelt preaches too much. He lays down the singular proposition that a feeling of broad, radical, intense Americanism is necessary if good work is to be done in any direction. The sooner we get over talking about American systems of philosophy and ethics and art and devote ourselves to what is true and right and beautiful, the sooner we shall shake off our provincialism. The most that can be said of New York today is that it is a piece of honorable hackwork, tightly written, unflawed by any trace of originality. One or two passages are of semi-autobiographical interest. Roosevelt can never resist injecting himself and his personal opinions into a historical narrative. And his command of urban details is at least as impressive as that of Western material in his earlier histories. The section dealing with the unprecedented tidal wave of immigration that battered New York after the War of 1812 is an early example of Roosevelt's fascination with ethnic turnover, as he called it. The public school system and the all-pervading energy of American life proved too severe solvents to be resisted even by the German tenacity. The children of the first generation were half, and the grandchildren in most cases wholly, Americanized, to their own inestimable advantage. There is also a characteristic passage that describes policemen attacking the draft rioters with the most wholesome intent to do them physical harm. 30 rioters were slain, an admirable object lesson to the remainder. Roosevelt was working in his office on the afternoon of Tuesday, 24 March, regretting that there was just enough paper on his desk to keep him from the winning of the West, when a Mr. John C. Rose of Baltimore was shown in. Rose was counsel to the Maryland Civil Service Reform League, and as such considered himself a watchdog over the law in his hometown. He had serious irregularities to report. A Republican primary was scheduled in Baltimore for the following Monday, Rose explained. Its purpose was to elect delegates to the Maryland State Convention, which would in turn establish procedures for the election of delegates to the National Convention in 1892. At the moment, things were not going well for the Friends of Benjamin Harrison. It looked as if the city might choose an anti-administration slate. In that case, the president could forget about Maryland's votes when he ran for renomination. As a result, the local postmaster and U.S. Marshal, both Harrison appointees, were using their offices as emergency campaign chests. Senior federal employees were going around assessing subordinates for contributions ranging from $5 to $10 each. This was an open defiance of Section 1 of the Civil Service Code, prohibiting the solicitation of money for political purpose on government property. The money would certainly be used to bribe election judges on Monday, and there was no saying what other means the pro-administration forces might use to influence the course of the voting. Rose begged Roosevelt to come down and investigate the situation at once. Several witnesses were prepared to testify to the truth of his allegations. Roosevelt proved oddly coy. Although he did not say as much to Rose, he dreaded another contretemps with the Postmaster General, which would surely occur should he uncover further evidence of politicking in that gentleman's department. Wanamaker had been smarting ever since the Paul Scheide affair, and if stung once more could be expected to fight tooth and nail for Roosevelt's removal. Stalling for time, the commissioner asked Rose to return to Baltimore and put his information in writing. When the letter arrived 2 days later, he sent it on to Wanamaker, suggesting that, as most of the allegations therein referred to the post office, the Postmaster General should perhaps investigate them himself. Wanamaker declined. Roosevelt felt he had done what he could to protect the administration, and must now do his duty. With his usual flair for the dramatic, he chose to arrive in Baltimore unannounced on the morning of Election Day, 30 March. As he wandered through the noisy wards, he saw enough evidence of wanton illegality by federal employees to fill a fleet of police wagons. He tried to maintain an air of official disapproval, but the writer in him could not help rejoicing in scenes and incidents straight out of Pickwick Papers. On every sidewalk, fists flew and money, taxpayers' money, changed hands, while in house windows overlooking the street, Election judges sat in impassive groups of three, like monkeys who saw, heard, and spoke no evil. Relays of furniture carts rumbled in from all points of the compass, bringing hundreds of rural voters with no apparent connections to the local Republican Party. Ward workers entertained these transients in saloons, where the beer flowed freely, compliments of Postmaster Johnson and Marshal Airy. Countless pudding tickets, six or seven slips folded together as one, were deposited on behalf of both factions. When a judge objected to this, his two colleagues threw him bodily into the crowd. Elsewhere, an anti-administration worker eliminated three pro-administration judges by the simple expedient of pulling a blind down over their window. "On account of this excessive zeal," wrote Roosevelt admiringly, "he was taken to the watchhouse and fined." The polls closed at 8 o'clock, and although there seemed to be 3 to 4 times as many votes as voters, the majority were clearly in favor of the anti-administration forces. Roosevelt had no comment to make. He was busy interviewing federal employees who had contributed to or participated in the day's proceedings. Not one of them saw anything wrong in influencing the course of a political election. "As far as I could find out," Roosevelt recalled, "there seemed to be no question of principle at stake at all, but one of offices merely. It was not a primary which particularly affected the interest of private citizens." The civil servants of Baltimore, he added, were as thorough believers in a system of oligarchical government as if they had lived in Venice or Sparta. Party reaction to his visit was immediate and violent. On 1 April, the Washington correspondent of the Boston Post reported, "The removal of Theodore Roosevelt from the Civil Service Commission is among the possibilities of the near future." The president, apparently, was very mad with him. Frank Hatton delightedly fanned the flames with a front-page story headlined, "Teddy at the Polls, Helping to Hurt Mr. Harrison. He is hand in glove with the anti-administration men." The article alleged that Roosevelt's tour through the wards had caused many government employees to desert the field, resulting in a humiliating defeat for the administration. "If the delegation sent to the next nominating convention is anti-Harrison, the president will have nobody to blame more than his civil service commissioner." On 4 April, an incensed party of Maryland spoilsmen visited the White House to demand Roosevelt's dismissal. Harrison said he would wait for an official report of the investigation before deciding what to do. This was a clear warning to Roosevelt to modify, delay, or even suppress any embarrassing findings. Aware that he had an axe hanging over him, an axe that threatened to split asunder not only the Civil Service Commission, but the entire administration, Roosevelt drafted his report with extreme caution. He returned to Baltimore 3 times, on 6, 13, and 18 April, to gather extra material. Every word of testimony was transcribed by a stenographer, lest the president doubt any of the evidence. Some interviews, despite his efforts to be severe, came out like music hall dialogue. Question: "How do you do your cheating?" Answer: "Well, we do our cheating honorably." Although Roosevelt quoted such non sequiturs with relish, the cheerful mendacity of witness after witness gradually sickened him. "Out of their own mouths," he wrote, "no fewer than 25 Harrison appointees stood convicted, and the president should dismiss them at once." His analysis of the evidence contained a typically aggressive plea for the abolition of the spoil system, on the grounds of pure political morality. "Resolved into its ultimate elements, the view of the spoils politician is that politics is a dirty game, which ought to be played solely by those who desire, by hook or crook, to win pecuniary reward in the form of money or of office. Politics cannot possibly be put upon a healthy basis until this idea is absolutely eradicated. As for the government office holder, he must be taught in one way or another that his duty is to do the work of the government for the whole people, and not to pervert his office for the use of any party or any faction." In conclusion, Roosevelt noted that Postmaster Johnson had weakly disclaimed responsibility for the politicking of his employees. Such men were loyal not to him, but to their ward leaders, who had ordered Johnson to hire them in the first place. "This testimony," Roosevelt remarked contemptuously, "shows the utter nonsense of the talk that under the spoil system, the appointing officers themselves make the appointments. They do nothing of the kind. Outside politicians make the appointments for them." There was not enough evidence to warrant indictment of either Johnson or Marshal Airy, although the latter had been seen tearing the coat buttons off a recalcitrant judge. In an obvious attempt to placate the president, Roosevelt avoided direct censure of either official, but suggested that in future, any such politicking by senior civil servants shall be treated as furnishing cause for dismissal. The report of Commissioner Roosevelt concerning political assessments and the use of official influence to control elections in the federal offices at Baltimore, Maryland, was and remains a masterpiece in its genre. It was short, 146 pages, dense with relevant information, yet so clearly written as to speed both reader and author irresistibly to the same conclusion. Indeed, the document was so seductive, not to say seditious, in its indictment of old guard republicanism, that Roosevelt himself seems to have had second thoughts about sending it in, or at least to have yielded to the suggestions of Commissioners Lyman and Thompson that he delay its release until the summer vacations, when negative publicity would do the administration least harm. As a result, he enjoyed a temporary lull in his warfare with the ungodly, and drifted into the pleasant life one can lead in Washington in the spring if there are several tolerably intimate families. The Roosevelts dined the Reeds. The Reeds responded with lunch. The Hayes dined the Roosevelts, and good, futile, pathetic Springy entertained everybody at the country club. Theodore and Edith made side trips to Senator Cameron's estate in Pennsylvania and to William Merritt Chase's art studio in New York, where Carmencita performed the new dance sensation, Flamenco. April was effulgent, clear as a bell, the flowers in bloom, and the trees a fresh and feathery green. There were moonlight drives along the Potomac, followed by dinner. Receptions for various Dago diplomats, followed by dinner. Lazy Saturday lunches and lingering Sunday teas, followed by yet more dinners. Roosevelt, whose body was thickening steadily with age, attempted to lose weight by trotting up Rock Creek in heavy flannels. His Dutch Reformed conscience began to bother him. "I have been going out too much. I wish I had more chance to work at my books. I don't feel as if I were working to lasting effect." Sometime that spring, he was overjoyed to receive a temperate, natural, truthful letter from his brother, whom Bammy had at last told about Katie Mann. It amounted to a total rejection of the girl's story. Naively reassured, Theodore wondered if he should call her bluff. "It is a ticklish business," he told Bammy. "I hate the idea of a public scandal, and yet I never believe in yielding a hair's breadth to a case of simple blackmail." But Katie Mann, who had given birth to a son, was not in the least deterred from pressing her suit. She claimed that Elliot had given her a locket and some compromising letters, which she would be happy to produce in court. Other servants, moreover, were willing to testify that he had been infatuated with her and that his voice had been heard in her room. "Of course she is lying," Theodore wrote uneasily. He was still wondering how to proceed when the reports from Europe took on a sudden, alarming turn. Elliot had quit the sanitarium in Graz on some wild impulse and had dragged Anna, Bammy, and the children to Paris. There, he had taken on an American mistress, a Mrs. Evans, begun to drink again, and was occasionally so violent as to frighten Anna into hysterics. Theodore chafed with frustration. Were it not for the fact that his own wife was heavily pregnant, he would have taken the next ship to Paris. He insisted in a brutally decisive letter dated 7 June that Elliot must be left to drink himself to death, if necessary, the moment Anna's confinement was over. "Anna must be made to understand that it is both maudlin and criminal, I am choosing my words with scientific exactness, to continue living with Elliot. Do everything to persuade her to come home at once, unless Elliot will put himself in an asylum for a term of years, or unless, better still, he will come too. Once here, I'll guarantee to see that he is shut up. Make up your mind to one dreadful scene. Use this letter if you like. Tell him that he is either responsible or irresponsible. If responsible, then he must go where he can be cured. If irresponsible, he is simply a selfish, brutal, and vicious criminal, and Anna ought not to stay with him an hour. Do not care an atom for his threats of going off alone. Let him go. What happens to him is of purely minor importance now. And the chance of public scandal must not be weighed for a moment against the welfare, the life, of Anna and the children. If he can't be shut up, and will neither go of his own accord nor let Anna depart of his free will, then make your plans and go off some day in his absence. If you need me, telegraph me, and I, or Douglas Robinson, if it is impossible for me to go on account of Edith, will come at once. But remember, I come on one condition. I come to settle the thing once and for all. You can tell him that Anna has a perfect right to a divorce. She or you or I but have to express belief in the Katie Mann story, and no jury in the country would refuse a divorce. Notwithstanding his threat to uphold Katie Mann in court, Theodore still wanted to believe that the girl was lying. As a gentleman, he had to accept his brother's denial until it was proved false. He therefore ordered his representatives to tell her to go on with her lawsuit. She will get nothing from us. Senior members of the family were alerted to the likelihood of some pretty ugly matters surfacing in the press. At this point, another letter arrived from Elliot, reiterating his innocence, but authorizing Theodore to pay Katie Mann a moderate sum in exchange for a quitclaim. The lawyer suggested $3,000, rising to $4,000 if necessary. That was much more than Elliot had in mind, but they reminded Theodore that in cases of this kind, involving boozy playboys and humble servant girls, the jury's sympathy was always with the plaintiff. In a letter to Dear Old Nell, dated 14 June 1891, Theodore tried desperately to convince his brother, and himself, that the amount was worth paying. "If you and I were alone in the world, I should advise fighting her as a pure blackmailer. Yet, as things are, I did not dare. The woman must admit that on her own plea she must have been a willing, probably inviting, party. But she has chosen her time with great skill. During that week of the alleged seduction, you were very sick, and for hours at a time were out of your head, and did not have any clear recollection of what you were doing. You wandered much about the house those nights alone. She could get testimony that you were often wild and irresponsible, either from being out of your head or from the use of liquor or opiates. At present, you are not in any condition to go on the stand and be cross-examined as to your past and your personal habits by a sharp and unscrupulous lawyer. So that, however the suit went, it would create a great scandal, and much would be dragged out that we are very desirous of keeping from the public." This appeal to his brother's sense of reason was rendered academic by a letter from Bammy the next day, saying that Elliot had begun to suffer from delirium tremens. Worse news arrived with almost every mail. Elliot no longer denied sleeping with Katie Mann. He merely said he could not remember doing so. He refused to be shut up against his will, and threatened to cut Anna off without a penny if she deserted him. Simultaneously, he threatened to go off on a long sea voyage as soon as her baby was born. "He is evidently a maniac morally, no less than mentally," Theodore wrote in despair. As the commissioner pondered each fresh letter and telegram, he could detect a certain animal ruthlessness in Elliot's behavior. What that golden sot really wanted was to have everything, to hold on to his wife and children as symbols of respectability, to drink as much as he liked, sleep with whomever he pleased, and squander his money on himself rather than alimony in paternity suits. Elliot could not care less about Katie Mann's threats. He knew that the family elders were so afraid of scandal they would silence her at all costs. If he refused to pay her the $4,000, somebody else assuredly would. Theodore did not doubt this, having already, in an unfortunate gaffe, told Elliot that an uncle was willing to provide the hush money. He confessed to Bammy on 20 June that he was at his wit's end as to what to advise. He could only insist ad nauseam that Anna must come home and not condone Elliot's hideous depravity by continuing to live with him as man and wife. But there seemed little chance of that. Bammy wrote to say that Anna had called longingly for Elliot while giving birth to their son, Hall, on 28 June. "It is dreadful to think of the inheritance the poor little baby may have in him," Theodore wrote somberly, and prophetically. The thought of Elliot now being free to return to Anna's bed saddened and sickened him. In his opinion, sex between them should cease until Elliot, by 2 or 3 years of straight life, had canceled out the sin of adultery. It did not occur to him that Anna, who had no sins to atone for, might be in any way inconvenienced by such an arrangement. Roosevelt's worries about Katie Mann, aggravated by nervousness over the political consequences of his Baltimore report, still pigeonholed despite frantic pleas from reformers for its release, plunged him into gloom as June gave way to July. "I am at the end of my career, such as it is," he wrote to Henry Cabot Lodge. "I often have a regret that I am not with you, Reed, and others in doing the real work." About the only people who seemed to approve of him at the moment were the mugwumps, and he needed none of their lisping praises. The good party men, whose respect he craved, seemed to cherish nothing but bitter animosities toward him. His mood was not improved by an awkward business meeting with President Harrison on 1 July. Throughout the interview, he was as disagreeable and suspicious of manner as well might be, Roosevelt wrote Lodge. He is a genial little runt, isn't he? Actually, the meeting had positive results. Harrison approved some new civil service rules governing promotions, which Roosevelt had been pressing as part of his campaign to root out favoritism in government departments. But the coolness between the two men was such that even their treaties seemed like truces. Roosevelt was now free to leave Washington for the summer, there being little work in his hot, musty office that he could not do at Sagamore Hill. Edith and the children had long since preceded him north, and he missed them so painfully he would look over his shoulder for them on walks through Rock Creek Park. Pausing only to stuff a suitcase with fireworks, he caught the Limited to New York on Friday, 3 July, arriving home in time for the holiday. It was not a very festive weekend. On Sunday, he was obliged to cross the Sound for the funeral of his cousin, Alfred, killed horribly under the wheels of a train, and he returned to news that Katie Mann had finally named her price, $10,000. This, Theodore wrote Bammy, was so huge a sum that the hoped-for compromise seemed unlikely. The scandal would break any day now, he feared. It was impossible to deny Elliot's culpability. An expert in likenesses had seen the baby, and its features were unmistakably Rooseveltian. Telegrams from Europe crossed his letter to report that Elliot had been inveigled into an inebriate asylum outside Paris. He was now safely under lock and key, and Bammy had persuaded Anna to return to the States without him. About this time, the figure of Katie Mann begins mysteriously to fade from history. The last specific reference to her in Theodore's correspondence is a remark dated 21 July. Frank Weeks, Elliot's lawyer, advises me that I have no power whatever to compromise in the Katie Mann affair. I suppose it will all be out soon. But the scandal never broke. Evidently the girl got her money, although how much and when and who paid it is unknown. A scandal of another sort began to loom on 4 August, when Roosevelt sent advance copies of his Baltimore report to the White House and Post Office Department. Official reaction to the document was best symbolized by Assistant Postmaster General Clarkson, who took one look at it and placed it under lock and key. An abridged form of the report was released for publication on 16 August and instantly became front-page news. Fortunately, both President Harrison and Postmaster General Wanamaker were on vacation and would not return until early September, by which time Roosevelt planned to be 2,000 miles west in the Rockies. The inevitable confrontation between them would thus be delayed until October at least. Try as he might, Roosevelt could not keep his name out of current headlines. On 17 August, the day after his Baltimore report was broadcast to the nation, the New York Sun splashed the following sensational story. Elliot Roosevelt insane. His brother Theodore applies for a writ in lunacy. A commission has been appointed by Justice O'Brien of the Supreme Court to inquire into the mental condition of Elliot Roosevelt, with a view to having a committee appointed to care for his person and for his estate. The application was made by his brother, United States Civil Service Commissioner and ex-Assemblyman Theodore Roosevelt, with the approval of Elliot Roosevelt's wife, Anna Hall Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt avers in the papers in the case that the mental faculties of his brother have been failing him for nearly 2 years. He says he saw him frequently until Elliot went to Europe in July 1890, and he had remarked the gradual impairment of his intellect. His conversation had been rambling, and he could not tell a story consecutively. During the winter of 1890, he had several bad turns. He became violent, and on 3 occasions threatened to take his own life. He had to be placed in surveillance. Mr. Roosevelt says he is unable to say how far the result is due to indulgence in drink or other excesses. He alleges that the property of his brother in this state consists of real estate, bonds, stocks, and is worth $170,000. Substantially, the same news item appeared in all the major dailies. Never before had the Roosevelts, that 250-year-old clan of unimpeachable respectability, been tarnished with such shameful revelations. The resentment of family elders against Theodore for having precipitated it may well be imagined, but he was convinced he had done the right thing for Anna and the children. It had been necessary to act hastily before Elliot was released from his French asylum and returned to the United States to claim his property. Even so, the court might not decide in time. "It is all horrible beyond belief," Theodore wrote Bammy. "The only thing to do is go resolutely forward." All in all, the summer of 1891 must have been a time of anguish for the beleaguered commissioner. Its only discernible blessing was the birth, on 13 August, of his fourth child and second daughter, a jolly, naughty, wacky baby named Ethel. Even this was saddened by the almost simultaneous death of Wilmot Dow, the younger and more lovable of his Dakota partners. "I think of Wilmot all the time," he wrote. "I can see him riding a bucker, paddling, shooting, hiking." Solace was to be found out west. At the end of the month, he left for Medora and the Rockies. "As usual, I come back to rumors of my own removal," Roosevelt wrote Lodge on 10 October. But the tone of his letter was spirited. He had killed 9 elk in 4 weeks and felt in splendid trim for a fight. General opinion held that he was too popular to be fired. "Mr. Harrison could be consoled if Mr. Roosevelt would resign," the New York Times remarked. "But he will not, and the president will not dare ask him to do so." Amazingly, even Frank Hatton hoped the rumors were not true. "Mr. Roosevelt is a sincere and genuine civil service reformer. There have been times in the past when his ideas of reform did not exactly commingle with those of the post, but it will be a sad day for civil service reform when he steps down and out." Postmaster Johnson of Baltimore did not share this view. He publicly prayed that lightning may strike Mr. Theodore Roosevelt. John Wanamaker no doubt added a fervent amen. It was clearly his responsibility to dismiss the 25 post office employees who had, by their own testimony, indicted themselves in Roosevelt's report. Yet his pride would not let him. Shortly after the pesky commissioner returned to town, Wanamaker handpicked a team of postal department inspectors and ordered them to reinvestigate the Baltimore case, since the evidence gathered so far is inconclusive. Now it was Roosevelt's turn to be angry. "You may tell the Postmaster General from me," he roared at a messenger, "that I don't like him for 2 reasons. In the first place, he has a very sloppy mind, and in the second place, he does not tell the truth." Embarrassments crowded in thickly as the year drew to its close, so much so that Roosevelt forgot his own 33rd birthday. The Maryland Civil Service Reform League complained about his ineffectiveness in securing the 25 dismissals and said a golden opportunity to educate the rest of the country had been lost. Reformers in New York sent word that the law was being abused there just as cynically as it had been in Baltimore. And in Washington, President Harrison brushed aside a plan for new promotion methods in the classified service which Roosevelt had worked on for many months. Instead, cabinet officers were told they could promote as they pleased, without further reference to the Civil Service Commission, leaving the agency even weaker than before. Financial worry continued to plague Roosevelt. The expense of maintaining 2 households and moving his family back and forth twice a year had caused an escalation of his debts. Ethel's arrival during the summer had made it impossible to live any longer in the little house on Jefferson Place, so the commissioner rented a larger establishment at 1215 19th Street for the new season. Personal frustration always tended to increase Roosevelt's natural belligerency, and that winter's news of the mob killing of 2 American sailors in Valparaiso, Chile, made him rampant for war, as he had been in 1886, over the Mexican border incident. To his disgust, the United States merely asked Chile to apologize. An amused John Hay wrote to Henry Adams, "Teddy Roosevelt goes about hissing through his clenched teeth that we are dishonest. For 2 nickels he would declare war himself, shut up the Civil Service Commission, and wage it sole." On top of everything, there was the vexatious problem of what to do about Elliot. The insanity suit was getting nowhere, owing to disagreement between the certifying doctors and bickering among various relatives. Elliot had published a denial of his madness in the Paris edition of the Herald and lodged a formal protest with the court in New York. He kept sending unspeakably terrible letters to Theodore, some of them penitent, others vituperative. "They are so sane," his brother marveled, "and yet so absolutely lacking in moral sense." In the last week of November, Roosevelt succumbed to an attack of severe bronchitis, and the doctor warned it might turn to pneumonia. He recovered briefly, only to collapse again in December. Edith ordered him to bed for 8 days, his longest recorded confinement since childhood. Although he complained about being treated like a corpulent valetudinarian, it was plain that he was physically and emotionally spent. Christmas with the bunny chillum restored him to health, and by New Year's Day his metabolism was running at top speed again. About this time, he made a lightning decision to cross the Atlantic and confront his brother with an out-of-court settlement. Instinct told him that Elliot, too, had slipped into despair recently, and that now or never was the time to shock him back to his senses. Elliot had always worshipped him. "Oh, Father, will you ever think me a noble boy? You're right about T.D. He is one, and no mistake." Had always craved his authority, even when protesting he could do without it. They must square off again, just as they had in the days when Theodore was skinny and Elliot was swelly. First round, results. Skinny, lip swelled and bleeding. Swelly, sound in every limb if nose and lip can be classed as such. But this time, Skinny intended to be the victor. President Harrison sympathetically granted his request for leave of absence, and he sailed from New York on 9 January 1892. There followed a period of anxious suspense for the family, broken by this triumphant letter from Paris, dated 21 January.
1. Thank heaven I came over. I found Elliot absolutely changed. I was perfectly quiet, but absolutely unwavering and resolute with him. And he surrendered completely and was utterly broken, submissive, and repentant. He signed the deed for 2/3 of all his property, including the $60,000 trust, and agreed to the probation. I then instantly changed my whole manner and treated him with the utmost love and tenderness. I told him we would do all we legitimately could to get him through his 2 years or thereabouts of probation, that our one object now would be to see him entirely restored to himself, and so to his wife and children. He today attempted no justification whatever. He acknowledged how grievously he had sinned and failed in his duties, and said he would do all in his power to prove himself really reformed. He was in a mood that was terribly touching. How long it will last, of course, no one can say. Part of the agreement was that Elliot, in exchange for the withdrawal of the writ of insanity, would return to the United States and undergo a 5-week cure for alcoholism at the Keeley Center in Dwight, Illinois. This coming after his 6-month drying out period at Suresnes would enable him to start working again and re-enter society by degrees. Should he prove himself sober and responsible, he might resume family life sometime in 1894. Theodore remained in Paris another full week before sailing from Le Havre on 27 January. It seems he wanted to punch every last ounce of immorality out of Elliot. Having done so, he left him to follow one day later, alone on a separate steamer. On 28 January, Elliot's mistress, Mrs. Evans, made the following entry in her diary. "This morning, with his silk hat, his overcoat, gloves, and cigar, E. came to my room to say goodbye. It is all over. Now my love was swallowed up in pity, for he looked so bruised, so beaten down by the past week with his brother. How could they treat so generous and noble a man as they have? He is more noble a figure in my eyes, with all his confessed faults, than either his wife or brother." Roosevelt returned home on 7 February to find the Civil Service Commission pondering yet another case of political assessments, this time at federal offices in Owensboro, Kentucky. His presence was required in that state as soon as possible, but with the social season at its height, he did not feel like immediately embarking on another journey. Elliot had expressed a desire to go south with him at the end of March, after the Keeley cure was complete. Until then, the Owensboro district attorney would simply have to muddle along. Besides, the Kentucky case served as an exasperating reminder that nothing whatsoever had been done in Baltimore. It was now almost a year since his investigation, and the 25 lawbreakers were all still in office, drawing government salaries. John Wanamaker's inspectors had filed their report the previous November, but the Postmaster General would not say whether it confirmed or denied Roosevelt's findings. He also refused to send a copy to the Civil Service Commission, saying that it was an internal document, for his eyes only. On 8 March, Roosevelt made a special trip to New York in order to shout, "Damn John Wanamaker!" at an executive meeting of the city's Civil Service Reform Association. Crimson with rage, he launched into an account of the whole case, accusing Wanamaker and Harrison of obstruction of justice.
He was sure that the postal inspector's report would corroborate his own. But how could its findings be made public? The veteran reformer Carl Schurz made a simple suggestion. Roosevelt must demand a House investigation into the undeniable fact that 25 federal employees recommended for dismissal in July 1891 were still on the federal payroll in March 1892. It would be difficult for the House to refuse such a request. Wanamaker would then be obliged to present the inspector's report as grounds for his inaction. It would become part of the public record, and the Civil Service Reform League would see to it that millions of copies were distributed around the nation. If the document turned out to be a whitewash job, Wanamaker would be humiliated. If it duplicated Roosevelt's original findings, Wanamaker would be destroyed. Either way, the cause of civil service reform would benefit. Roosevelt lost no time in following Schurz's advice. While awaiting the verdict of the House, he made his planned trip to the South with Elliot, who had agreed to manage Douglas Robinson's estates in Virginia. The two brothers parted affectionately. Elliot declared he was completely cured and anxious to atone for his misdeeds. Theodore went on to Kentucky, relieved that the long family crisis was over. "It is most inadvisable on every account that you and I should have any leading part in Elliot's affairs hereafter," he wrote Bammy, "especially as regards his relations with Anna. We have done everything possible. Anything more would simply be interference, would not ultimately help her or him, and would hurt us." His business in Owensboro did not detain him long. Neither did further business in Texas, for in early April he was at the ranch of a friend near the Mexican border. Here he spent two exhilarating days hunting wild hogs on horseback. Running down a band of five on the banks of the River Nueces, he managed to shoot a sow and a boar. "There was a certain excitement in seeing the fierce little creatures come to bay," he mused afterward. "But the true way to kill these peccaries would be with the spear." The House voted an investigation of the Baltimore affair by the Civil Service Reform Committee on 19 April 1892. John Wanamaker was asked how soon he could prepare a statement of his official position, and replied that he would hold himself at the service of the committee for any date on which Mr. Roosevelt was not to be present. A special hearing of the Postmaster General was promptly scheduled for Monday, 25 April. Speaking with an air of weary dignity, Wanamaker said he had not laid eyes on Roosevelt's report until returning from vacation the previous September. Soon afterward, Postmaster Johnson had written to him complaining that the document was based on warped evidence. According to Johnson, Commissioner Roosevelt had arrived in Baltimore without warning and had frightened and bulldozed post office employees into making rash statements that they later begged to withdraw. He had conducted a Star Chamber investigation in which men of very ordinary intellect were denied counsel and subjected them to a barrage of leading questions. Wanamaker felt that the men were entitled to be heard on their own behalf, and had ordered his two most senior inspectors to reinvestigate the case. Their report, which he did not happen to have on him at the moment, proved that Roosevelt's victims had not been soliciting election expenses at all. On the contrary, they were merely raising funds for a pool table. It was the official view of his department, therefore, that the facts do not justify the dismissal of anyone for violation of the civil service law as charged. Wanamaker, who regularly taught Sunday school in Philadelphia, was at his sanctimonious best in cross-examination. He said that Postmaster Johnson had been reprimanded for allowing his men to give impressions to the Civil Service Commissioner which were not justified by facts. Yet on the whole, Johnson had done a remarkably good job in enforcing civil service rules. "The condition of the Baltimore Post Office is like the millennium in comparison with what it was in the previous administration." Then, Wanamaker launched into a speech which must have made Roosevelt boggle when it appeared in the evening paper. "I consider myself the highest type of civil service man. I have governed the post office department strictly by civil service rules. It seems to me to be small and trifling business and unworthy of a great government to discharge a man who declares that he gave $5 to a pool table. And while I have not seen my way clear to order any discharge or indictment, I might, if I saw the least thing on the part of these men at the next election to prove that they had not been honest or fair, dismiss them and 40 more, if necessary. I am a law keeper." Roosevelt's turn came a week later, on 2 May. He made his usual delayed entrance, interrupting testimony by Treasury Secretary Charles Foster, pumping hands right and left, waving aside a proffered chair. While awaiting his turn on the stand, he paced the floor nervously like a caged leopard,